His adopted name is Joseph Schultz, and his India Joe's restaurant was the West Coast capital of fusion foodieism. The taste that lingers of that fusion leads one to ask, how can one cook east into west so the hungry return for more?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1294th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Santiago who are tuned into the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, before it was inappropriate to appropriate the food of other cultures for one's own purposes, there was India Joe's restaurant in the tiny town of Santa Cruz, California. India Joe's was both a culinary and a cultural hotspot in which one could taste a fusion of the world's foods and foment a revolt against the dominant paradigm at the same time. And it was, and it still is, difficult to tell which of the two pursuits the restaurant's namesake owner and chef, India Joseph Schultz, enjoyed most. Here is a taste of his thinking, as found in a manuscript entitled Chutney, which I found in a hard-to-find place. Cooks find their own answers, and being a good, inventive cook involves learning not only more answers, but also the questions the answers address. Cooking does not exist independently of eating. The idea that there is an ideal of good cooking to which we all strive is an amusing parochial concept. Almost nothing can be done in the name of cooking which isn't done in some part of the world. The results seem bizarre, weird, unappetizing, only out of the context of the specific questions they answer. So why chutney? What do we want them to be? What do we want them to answer? Why call them chutneys? Isn't that misleading? India Joseph Schultz will soon be closing the latest iteration of the India Joe's restaurant, but before he moves on to what's next, we just have to ask him, how can one cook east into west so the hungry return for more? Joe's, welcome to the Food Chain.
Great to be here, Michael.
So, many years of blending east and west and north and south, is there any culture's food you have not taken and made into something else?
Well, I've done a lot of exploring in the world's cuisines, let's just say. I haven't eaten a lot of whale blubber.
There you go.
But
they say it's nutritious.
They say it's, I'm sure it's high in calories.
Yeah, and probably a lot of good essential fatty acids too.
Yeah.
And I understand that the Eskimos don't have heart attacks.
That's what they say, yeah.
Wow. So, Foodie for the People, you're the subject of a new documentary that's coming out very shortly here. And so you're going to be world famous.
It's a frightening prospect, I have to say.
Okay. And the reason you're going to become famous, or are famous in many circles, is two reasons as I see it. One is that your food... you've been a chef for 50 years, and you're also a cultural entrepreneur as such. You bring people together, and both of which were embodied in your India Joe's restaurant here in Santa Cruz, California. And which do you think is most fun, cooking or people?
Well, it's really hard to say. I get overwhelmed by people sometimes. Food is wonderfully non-threatening in the way that people can be. But food is such a wonderful way of bringing people together that it's hard to separate the food from the people.
Amen to that. How did you become India Joe's? What happened to Joseph Schultz?
Well, it sort of was a series of accidents. I think it had to say I was bewitched by the Beatles at an early age, and at that point in their trajectory, India seemed like the font of all knowledge, all cosmic certainties. And so Indian cooking was like this new and wonderful realm that I sort of stumbled into with the help of some friends. And it just seemed like that wonderful horizon we glimpse and head towards. And so I spent my time trying to find what was that elusive, wonderful flavor that I'd never had before. And Indian was it at that point.
And there you and you brought that to the sleepy little village of Santa Cruz, California, at a time when the sleepy little village was kind of waking up to the world.
Yeah, so well, with the UC Santa Cruz beginnings, you know, the world sort of came to Santa Cruz in many ways, and I was so excited at that possibility of learning from, you know, the past and the cultures of all over, and it had a chance to rub shoulders with many, many different cultures. Through the academic world, mostly at that point.
Mm-hmm. Well, to make sense of all this, let's talk chutney.
All right.
What the heck is chutney for those of us who don't know?
Okay, well, a chutney is a taste toucher, a flavor tingler, a grace note, an extra sort of flavor that pushes the flavors around. Indian food often separates out the flavors of a meal into a bunch of different little stars in the constellation of an Indian dinner. And the chutneys are the bright spots. A chutney is sort of generally somewhat over the top in its balance. It's a little too hot. It's a little too sweet. It's a little too sour. And as such, you can appreciate it best by mixing it with other things. It keeps your tongue moving from one flavor to the other, basically.
Mm-hmm. You brought the world of chutneys to the little town of Santa Cruz with a chutney bar. Tell us about your chutney bar.
Well, it's always seemed to me that the eater is really the final chef. What food only exists as it is eaten. And if you have a bar of a lot of different flavors, then the diner gets to play with the food. And playing with your food seems like the most reasonable approach to having a business, because it excites people. It takes them to a place where they haven't been before.
Mm-hmm. And Indian food really is a place that many of us have not been before. And it's, you know, such a big part of the world's cuisine. Why has it been so removed from the American palate?
Well, India's not a culture that's traveled as much as many of the cultures. So, you know, the Greeks are known for their shipping and their maritime explorations. So you get Greek cooking all over the place. And, of course, Santa Cruz has a deep Italian background. But there wasn't a huge influence of Indian, you know, expatriates, you know, landing in this country and spreading their ideas. So Indian was something that was, you had to go there. It was the exotic that you had to travel to get. Of course, that's changed with globalization. But back then, it was very difficult to find even recipes. And so there was the allure of the unknown.
And that's what you brought to town, was that allure of the unknown, the exotic India Joes. And what you try to do is to make that exotic fit with to be normal, as it were.
Yeah, well, anthropologists often say that their business is to take the exotic and show how it's really normal, and to take the normal and show how it's really exotic.
And that's what you're doing with your food. So chutney being a good way of introducing the Indian tastes, of which there are many. Tell us about the tastes.
Well, all food basically comes down to a fairly limited number of tastes. We can taste sweetness, we can taste tartness, we can taste saltiness, we can taste bitterness, we can taste hotness, and we can taste oiliness. Other people break them down in different ways, but basically those are different sort of, shall we say, lights that go off when you eat food. And chutney is a sort of purified extracts of those particular flavors.
And so you can manage them in many different ways if there's that many different flavors that you mm-hmm. can work together into a chutney. You can really wreak havoc on a palate then.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, some of the chutneys are definitely sort of like a glimpse of a tiger in the jungle. They're a little bit over the edge, shall we say. Mm-hmm. And they're learning how to eat them is part of their fun, is that you touch it with your finger. You're not really even taking a spoonful, but that little teeny taste will completely enliven a mouthful in a way that no other cuisine really does.
So there's magic in it then.
Oh, absolutely. Alchemy and magic
in the cuisine. How did you go about learning how to mix these potions together into food?
Well, I had friends who were Indian, but also there was a nascent spiritual revolution in the late 60s that involved a lot of people, embracing, Eastern concepts and studying these things and sharing these things and learning about these things.
I guess I was a guilty one too, because I studied Chinese for,
Oh, absolutely.
Years. So I guess we were taken up all by a lot of different things in those days. But food, what a winner.
What a winner. We could all relate to it.
There it is. And so chutney is just the beginning then. I mean, it seems like it's almost your tool to really work your way into the whole world of Indian cuisine then.
Well, see, Indian cuisine does what I call perform an exegesis on flavors. It unpacks the different parts of a meal and puts them out on what they call a thali, a big platter. So you can see the different elements, and it clarifies the idea that there are different flavors going on. Now, one of the interesting things about flavor is if you taste the same flavor for very long, really a matter of seconds, you can't taste it anymore. It's only through the dancing from one flavor to the other that you actually have a wonderful flavor experience. And chutneys, I mean, you can't not go from one flavor to another, because they're separated for you on the plate.
So chutney, in effect, keeps the taste going.
Keeps things moving. Yep.
Wow. I never thought about that, but I guess I can see it. I can almost taste it. How exciting they are. Well, folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What, with the icon of Santa Cruz, California cooking, Joseph Schultz. He's the proprietor and chef of India Joe's, a very famous restaurant here in Santa Cruz, probably well known throughout the entire West Coast when it gets right down to it. And today we're talking about fusion of food and people. Right back.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, folks, What's Eating What is we're tasting the taste of India at the table of India Joe's, who is the chef and the proprietor of India Joe's restaurant. Retiring, you're looking at retiring now. India Joe's, 50 years of cooking?
Tired, I don't know about retiring. We'll see. We're evolving more than we're retiring.
There you go. And on to the next thing, right?
Yeah.
But in 50 years, you certainly learned a lot about preparing food, especially Indian food. What would you tell people about that have not tasted the taste that you are so familiar with making? How would you introduce somebody to that taste?
Well, it's the idea that flavor is something that you want to move around. You start with some sort of a fairly neutral food, and then you sort of instead of adding it to the food, you keep it separate and taste it separately. Chutneys are the Indian word, of course, but relishes, sambals, salsas, all these ideas of very sharp flavors that are presented separately from the meal are something we can all relate to. I mean, some flavors are going to be more, you know, exciting, and some people are going to be not as appealing. But the idea of moving from one flavor to the other is the place to start, to have a lot of flavors to work with and keep trying new ones.
Okay. Given that notion of moving from flavor to flavor and keeping things going, I'd like to talk about your restaurant, India Joe's, because it seems to me like, I guess it's the epitome of chutney. It had a way of keeping things going and forever changing. And boy, you ran that restaurant for many years. And as people look at, you know, opening their own restaurant, do you think they would use what you set up in India Joe's as a model for an efficient restaurant?
Well, not at all. No, India Joe's has been governed by the principle of randomness most of its life. I never had a business model. I never really had a clear concept, which is standard in the restaurant world, to sort of clarify a concept and sell it to the populace. For me, it was really more about playing with food and really having a good time. This is not a very viable business model, because one of the problems with food is that if people don't eat it, it doesn't exist. So you can have something on the menu you're very proud of. If for one reason or another people don't come in and get it, it doesn't exist.
Well, that's our opening question. How can one cook east into west and have the hungry come back for more? So it has to taste good.
It has to taste good.
And so much of the food, you know, that we eat doesn't really taste good.
It's true. Yeah, a lot of stuff is pretty boring. I don't think it needs to be. I don't think there's any cuisine that isn't capable of great culinary achievements. But all too often, if we just assume that it can't be good, if you don't try to make it good all the time, like I do, I'm always trying to make the absolute best of whatever it is I'm working with. That kind of devotion and passion for greatness, if you will, is the hallmark of an artistic success. That's not necessarily the hallmark of business success, however.
Mm-hmm. And I guess if India Joe's restaurant was known for anything, it was as an expression of art almost. That's why people loved it, because it was that different. And people went to this restaurant because it wasn't like any other restaurant. How did you go about introducing the concept of being different and of serving different food, of serving Indian food in a palette that was more used to cheeseburgers and French fries?
Well, I think it was Santa Cruz was a, you know, remember in the vanguard of some other interesting food movements like the Szechuan. The first Szechuan restaurants on the West Coast, maybe in the United States, happened in Santa Cruz.
New Riverside
down there. Yeah. And I lived literally a block away from that. So people were discovering that food could be something that was exciting, that wasn't just fuel for your life. And so people were open to the idea that food could be an unusual experience, could be a experience of discovery rather than of homecoming, if you will. And
so perhaps it given the tenor and the temper of the people here, it was probably a good place to introduce a concept like India Joe's. Whereas, you know, perhaps if you were in the suburbs of some other city, maybe it wouldn't work so well.
Absolutely. And, you know, Santa Cruz being a college town was part of it. You know, people, you know, college students are up for new experiences. They're you know, they're discovering the wider world. And the sort of the chili addiction that was springing up at that point, the idea that food could be really spicy, amazingly spicy, that's a draw. Because if you have people that are sort of on board with the idea that food can be alarmingly sort of difficult to eat, then I served Ethiopian food, and I served Sumatran food, and I served Balinese food, and these other very spicy cuisines. And the spiciness, which releases endorphins, which are somewhat addictive, that spiciness would lead people to try stuff they wouldn't ordinarily be interested in.
So, chilies. Tell us about which chilies to use. How did you go about discovering the world of chilies?
Well, chilies is a huge subject, and the chilies are a new world phenomenon. There's hundreds of different varieties of chilies found in Mexico, which is the epicenter of chili development. As you get further away from Mexico, and India and the Far East are pretty far from Mexico, the number of chilies they use diminishes, although you find, you know, certain chilies sort of latch on to a cuisine. The standard Indian chilies are different than the Mexican chilies. I tend to like jalapenos because they have a lot of chili flavor. They're quite hot and quite bitter, so you can get a lot of chili flavor without an extreme amount of heat where you would get with bird's eye chilies or things like that. I've sort of focused in on using chilies very precisely, so I grind chilies up so I can add, I can titrate the amount, because too hot is too hot. I mean,
right.
We all, you want to get one step beyond your comfort level, perhaps, but not four steps beyond your comfort level.
If you go into a conventional restaurant and ask for the spicy variety, it's usually pretty bland.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because nobody's going to take a chance on burning your lips.
Yeah. You know, especially in the early days of India Joe's, people were looking for hotter and hotter and hotter, because as you become accustomed to chilies, you want things much hotter than you're used to. So I would experiment with different chilies, and people want extra spicy, and their eyes would light up when you really hit them from different angles, and you use different kinds of chilies, to get a deep, hot profile.
And some of them you mix into your chutneys, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So, again, I tend to use just jalapenos are my go-to chili. Jalapenos and the red Indian chilies. But when I'm working with other cuisines, then I use other, you know, serranos are great. The Yunnan chilies in Chinese are great because they're not quite so hot. You can use a tremendous amount of them. Chutneys are a good place to play with chilies, because you want the chutneys to be over the top in their intensity. And because you don't eat tremendous amounts of it, it's okay for it to be super hot.
Yeah, so a little dabble do you.
A little dabble do
you. There you go. And away you go, too. So what else goes into the chutneys?
Well, because The way our senses work, for to really taste something, you have to have several of the flavors present at the same time. So you need some sort of tartness in a chutney, and that could be tamarind, or it could be lime juice or lemon juice. It could be vinegar. It could be, you know, unripe grapes. It could be, there's many different tarts. You generally want to anchor it with some salt as one of the flavors as well. The word salsa comes from the word for salt. And so salsas are a salt delivery vehicle, if you want to look at it that way. And then the other flavors, you're going to want some oiliness in it. Sometimes just the oil from the chili is enough, a little teeny bit of oil. And you want some sort of bitterness.
What does the oil taste deliver to you?
Well, oil, I mean, they didn't used to see it.
Kind of like a mouthfeel?
It's a mouthfeel. They've just recently, I mean, the research is still developing on these things. Oil is now thought of as a separate taste. I've been calling it a separate taste for about 40 years, and then suddenly science has caught up to us here. But there are certain taste receptors that respond to oil. And the reason for that probably evolutionarily is that oil is the most concentrated of energy of all the foods.
Probably one of the most difficult to get. Come by as well.
Yes, because it's precious, and oil has always been associated with richness and riches for
that
reason.
That's why we love butter.
That's why we love butter.
Good. And so mixing these things together, there's so many combinations.
Oh, absolutely.
In what you're talking about is that you're almost like a maestro of ingredients to make this work right.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're talking about a symphony of tastes, ideally, because you taste one thing, you taste another thing. You can have a chord where you have several things tasting at the same time. You can have an arpeggio where you're having tastes happening separately. That's what an arpeggio is. And as I say, in general, you want to be thinking about always having new tastes coming in to your mm-hmm. meal.
Well, you started out as an India Joe's, but now you're kind of experimenting with foods from all over the world.
Well,
for whale blubber, of course.
Yeah, except so for that. I don't eat octopus anymore either, for other reasons. As I discovered more about the history of food, I discovered that India is less central than I thought to the cuisines of the world. And so I discovered, you know, how the Neolithic Revolution took place in Persia and how that spread out and how, you know, they developed agriculture separately in China and in the Middle Americas. And so I, you know, try every cuisine I could find. Ethiopian is really interesting because they use many of the Indian spices, but they end up with very, very different effects because they use them quite differently. And so I really enjoy trying different cuisines, and always have.
It's kind of makes an anthropologist out of you, doesn't it?
Yeah, culinary anthropologist.
Culinary anthropologist. You know, in studying Chinese, especially the ancient Chinese poets and whatnot, I always kept an eye out for that which was universal. You know, something that was true in Chinese history and in Western history and the human condition and whatnot. If you see it develop as a truism in one culture and another culture that was entirely separate, you could think, well, that must be true then.
Well, this is how I discovered developed my theory of flavor saturation, which is that for food to taste good in any cuisine, you have to have all the flavors present. You know, they're fairly explicit about this in Thai cooking. They're much less explicit in Western cooking, where many of the flavors are already saturated. You get something like ham that has all the flavors there, prosciutto. So you add it, and you're adding all the flavors. So I discovered that, all cuisines seem to be adding all these flavors to things to make them up. And, you know, this has to do with...
So the five or six elements that you talked about.
So, I mean, some cuisines, as I say, they just are in the, you know, butter has all, it's pretty saturated. It has richness, it has saltiness, it has It has sweetness in it. It has obviously
oily.
Yeah. So I mean, I was always looking for the core principles underlying all these different changes. The Chinese, of course, have the Book of Changes, which is an explicit study of the universals, of how things actually, how the world interrelates with itself and how things work. And, you know, one of the principles I got from the I Ching is that when something's carried to extremes, it turns into its opposite.
Explain that.
Well, when you're talking about cooking, for example, if you get something very, very cold, at a certain point it becomes hot. And we all know how a margarita can be hot on its own. It's so cold that it'll burn you. Yeah. I mean, and
freeze your brain.
But chilies are another example. If you have enough chilies, you start sweating and you start getting cold. You experience the coolness within that heat.
And so the more things change.
I mean, the principles underneath them remain, but they talk about the 10,000 things in China, and underneath these 10,000 things are these rules of how things transform from one to another.
There you go. And we're going to transform ourselves really quickly here into a commercial break. But when we come back, I'd like to take India Joe's Schultz himself and have him teach us about running a restaurant that is truly unique in the world. India Joe's. This is The Food Chain. Right back.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Polyface Farms, Joel Salatin.
Few how-to books could be more appropriate for our times than MetroFarm, a truly comprehensive manual. MetroFarm makes the whole embedded food system doable. It's a must-read.
USDA Director Bud Kerr.
Big book. Metro Farm describes the agronomic, economic, and managerial concepts required to generate substantial profits from agricultural locales near metropolitan areas.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning Metro Farm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
Duke the Pug will soon turn 20, which is pretty good for a dog breed that averages 11 years. When Duke was 13, he lost a lot of hair, had a hard time getting up for a walk, and his bowel movements were not very moving. We started making his food instead of buying it. We cook up a big batch of rice, chicken, broccoli, carrots, and turmeric, freeze meal-sized batches, and thaw them at mealtime. We also sprinkle Arthrodex on each meal. Arthrodex is a complete blend of plant-derived minerals, vitamins, amino acids, and enzymes formulated to make old dogs young again. And it does. Duke the Pug does have his problems, but he has all his hair, loves daily walks, and has no problems with his movements. Breakfast is at 7, and if it's not there by 7:01, we all hear about it. Make your old dog young again. Pick up Arthrodex at NutriensToGo.com. And while you're at it, make yourself young again with a Healthy Body Start Pack. NutriensToGo.com. NutriensToGo.com.
History buffs. This tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place in Bremerton, Washington, August 1944.
Bremerton was the best Liberty port of the war, and I had a secret weapon for enjoying every second of it. Roller skates. No kidding. Now, right outside the gates of the base was a sailor bar, and almost every sailor would stop right there, but not me. I kept right on going till I get to the roller rink. Most of the guys thought I was nuts, but I wasn't. You see, there was no better way to meet girls than to skate around in a rink in your dress blues. Back in those days, I was limber enough to do tricks like wrapping one leg around my neck while I was skating on the other. Yeah, most of the guys thought I was crazy. They'd see me leaving the base with my skates and just shake their heads, but heck, I laughed all the way to the bank.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com. Talesfromatincan.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back. You know, this is the kind of show that makes you really hungry when you get right down to it. You're thinking about all of these hot, spicy foods, and it's going, boy. Hard to get that kind of food anywhere in the world except for India Joe's restaurant in Santa Cruz, California. There you can find it. And do you dare make people tear up with your spices?
Oh, absolutely. There's lots of people that just love that. They come up with their eyes streaming. That was so wonderful. That was great.
Yeah, and that is something that's really hard to find. So I'd like to address the notion of India Joe's restaurant because it really became a cultural phenomenon as well as a culinary one because people went there for people as much as the food. How did you engender that that feeling that this is the place to go? What did you
Well, do? I was really lucky, I have to say. I started out as a one-man band. Literally, I was cooking stuff and serving it and washing the dishes and buying it and everything. And people sort of were excited about what I was doing. And they said, I want to help. Lisa Pesci literally was a customer. I showed up at the restaurant and I'd forgotten my sound system. Gave her the keys to my house. Said, go grab my stereo system. And she worked with me for 5 years. Beth Regards, it's impossible to talk about India Joe's as a artistic phenomenon without talking about how Beth Regards sort of made the image, spiffy and sophisticated as well as offbeat. And so many people just sort of said, this looks like fun. I want to be part of it. That India Joe's became this artistic center. My cooking was certainly a major part of it. I won't talk that down. But India Joe's is inseparable from the people that just showed up and gave their all to the development of our stuff.
And you were pretty clever about marketing. And one of the more clever things that you did was you instituted a calamari festival.
Yeah, well, calamari was, it touches so many things. It's very local. And even back then, the idea
of... For those people who don't know, Santa Cruz is right on the Monterey Bay, and there are a lot of calamari, which are called squid for fishermen, out there in the bay.
Absolutely. And Santa Cruz, Monterey Bay calamari is found all over the world. When I was in Greece, they were selling Monterey calamari. But it was it appealed to me because it was cheap. They used it for bait back when I started.
And exactly. They still do.
But calamari is perfect for cooks because you can't be neutral about it. You eat chicken. Yeah, I eat chicken. I've had good chicken. You've had bad chicken. Calamari, you pay attention to, right? And all cooks want their diners to notice what they're eating. They don't want to just shovel it down. Oh, it was good. And calamari sort of wakes people up. It's alarming and exotic, and it's found in many, many, many different cuisines. And so it was perfect for a festival.
And how did you go about pulling a festival together? Where did you start? Because that was yours.
Well, I'd loved the idea of, working with a theme. As a musician would, you get a theme and you want a theme and variations. So, one year, I think it was 1979, I thought, well, there's all this great calamari. Let's do a calamari festival. And I had no idea how many people would show up. Hundreds and hundreds of people showed up the first time we did this. And one of the partners who accreted to the India Joe's experience was Tom Bresney, who was a genius at promotion. And we thought, let's take this and run with this. And it sort of grew from there. The word, the calamari consciousness, sort of became a real a force, shall we say, artistically and culinarily.
And it was a true local food too.
Absolutely.
In long before localism was a jihad, you made it one with a local food festival.
Yes. And it's great sort of knowing that this, these fishermen are getting this morning. I'm serving it this afternoon. Calamari is one of the most perishable of the foods. It You know, literally, if you keep it on ice, it's only good for about 2 days, and it goes disgusting. So
yeah, really bad, really fast.
Really bad, faster than other fish. And so that the idea that you know, kiss that joy as it flies. You know, he who binds himself a joy doth that winged lark destroy. But he who sips that joy as it flies lives in eternity's sunrise. That's what Blake put it. And a calamari was perfect for that, because you have to serve it. You have to prep it and serve it on the fly.
Now, you can prep it and serve it many different ways. How did you do it for the festival?
Well, I mean, calamari was this sort of underground secret in many of the world's cuisines, because it's so perishable. It wasn't something that was transported very well, so you'd find these sort of recipes in coastal Thailand or coastal India or things like that. And the Italians, which are a major part of Santa Cruz fishing community, especially in their early days, are very enthusiastic about calamari. And that was my first introduction to calamari, was through Italian dishes. And so we did, you know, stuffed calamari. And fried calamari it's very easy to do, but it's very hard to beat when it comes right down to just very simply fried in a batter, or actually it'll make its own batter if you just toss it with seasoned flour. So that was always very popular. The Greeks are very enthusiastic about calamari as well, and they serve it with a special kind of walnut garlic sauce. So that has been a staple of India Joe's legacy for, you know, again, 40 or 50 years now. But, you know, we go as far afield as possible from, you know, Persian calamari is a cream pomegranate reduction, which is a really good, probably our most popular dishes right now are the Persian calamari, Persian chicken, Persian calamari. But, you know, I'm always interested in cooking with calamari.
And where would you find Persian calamari except a place like India Joe's, who's not afraid to take a fly?
Well, yeah. India Joe's is not only a you know, global, but historical. The Persian calamari comes from a recipe in a 12th century Persian cookbook. It's not found in modern Persian cuisine at all, which has taken a very different turn. Good, but different. And so it's found in, you know, it has ancient Roman roots. It has, you know, ancient Persian roots. And yes, as far as I know, no one serves anything like that except India Joe's.
Well, and speaking of cookbooks, you've written three.
We've got three cookbooks out there. We've got a calamari cookbook, and I wanted to sing the praises of the humble chickpea, because chickpeas are also, it was sort of the opposite of calamari. It was a bland, neutral food that, you know, is, you know, no one pays much attention to. And then, of course, mushroom cookbook, because Santa Cruz is a center of mycological lore and has been since the David Aurora days in the 70s. And, you know, mushrooms are another food that no one's indifferent to, that people are, you know, they pay attention.
You have to.
You have to, or else you die.
Yeah, you pick the wrong mushroom, you can be in big trouble. And it always seems to happen once or twice a year. Somebody eats the wrong mushroom and ends up in the hospital.
Absolutely.
Or worse, yeah. So are these cookbooks still available?
Yeah, we've got copies of all of them still at the restaurant. I haven't really pushed it. Right now, the calamari cookbook has been out of print. I've been buying up copies on eBay and reselling them because they're hard to find. So we have a stock of them. It's, you know, that's a different career, being a writer. And all three of those books actually were written more than 20 years ago. There's other books forthcoming. I haven't decided what they're going to be yet.
Well, good. And perhaps you'll have a little time to do those. Which would
Let us
fun.
Hope. Running a restaurant is a very...
Tell us about that.
Well...
Because you started off as a one-man band, so you're doing everything, so you have absolutely no time for anything else then, right?
You wear a lot of hats when you're running it by yourself. Over at the peak of India Joe's, size, we had 80 employees. I had people doing everything and people showing other people how to do everything. And that ends up being as difficult as doing it by yourself if you're not really good at running people. And that's not my superpower. So actually, the current India Joe's has shrunk drastically again. And we have 1/10 the employees we did at our height. Mm-hmm. And but it means that, you know, something breaks, I'm the one that has to fix it. We ran out of something, I'm the one that has to go get it. There's no easy way to run a restaurant, is what I would say.
Especially a restaurant that has a unique character with unique tastes.
Absolutely. I mean, at this point, there's no one that can cook. I have no one that can cook the way I do. In the 80s and 90s, I had many cooks who were all as good or better than I was at actually running the line and putting the stuff out. They were young and fast and, you know, and together. Right now, you know, I'm in my dotage as a cook. I do my best, but it's again, when we're doing an enormously varied menu that takes split second timing, it gets very hard. And the curse of being popular is that people expect you to be able to cook as if you were cooking for them alone at their house, when actually I've got 40 other people who are expecting wonders at the same time.
And that's what makes you so unique. If you formalize, do you think you could package this? Do you think it'd be possible to develop a formula by which you could put an India Joe's out into the world?
Well, I tried. I have to, you know, like when I got a family in the 90s, I decided that I wanted to pass on this legacy. I mean, I had the great staff. I mean, I can't speak too highly of how well the India Joe's machine worked in the 80s and 90s. Best we ever had. And I sold the business because I wanted to spend time with my family. But the people that bought it, just although everything was running, but they couldn't keep it going. And it was after a year after this, it was embarrassing because my name was on it, but it really was not living up to its legacy. And I won't blame any particular person on the decisions that were made, but it's a very, very difficult operation to maintain it best. And I think the fact that it's also, you know, financially marginal, shall we say, to have that much energy going into a restaurant. Tremendous. I mean, my break-even point at that point was $4,000, $3,500 to $4,000 a day. And even if it's going really well, you're never more than, you know, a week from really difficult financial times. And that's true of any restaurant, not just mine.
And I guess that would explain why we end up with these really uniform kind of food presentations, like the fast food drive-thrus and whatnot. There's no taste in them, and there's no character, and there's nothing but food as quickly as you possibly can get it and get out of here.
Food becomes a commodity, and the nature of commodity is that it's interchangeable. That's what commodity means. It's something to be a commodity has to be interchangeable, whether it's steel or you know, chicken or whatever. You want things to be uniform and sort of universally available. And that's the opposite of what India Joe's is. Trying to commodify it does damage to the very nature of its central premise, which is that food is this delicate dance between an eater's expectations and the cook's abilities. And that isn't something you can talk about. It, you can make it into a slogan. But making it into a slogan does damage to the reality.
Doesn't hold it together. Once had a guy call me up from the deep south. Michael, I need your help, Michael. I grow the best watermelons in the south, and everybody says so, Michael, but I'm not making any money. I said, well, how do you sell them? He said, well, a guy comes by in a big truck and puts my watermelons up there with the neighbors, you know. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, why are you bothering to to grow a watermelon, the best watermelon, when you're selling them with all the rest of the watermelons? You turn your precious product into a commodity. And you never did you, India Jones?
No, there are some very fine chefs who really worked on packaging and commodifying their product. And that just was not an interesting project for me. I've got some friends who made millions and millions of dollars on very focused products. And that seemed like hell to me. The idea that I'm going to do nothing but produce this product and spread it as widely as possible just seemed like exactly what I did not want to live through.
And you never did?
Never did.
And so you left a wonderful taste that will linger for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
Because nobody cooks like India Jones. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for tuning in today. And remember Michael Olson's third law of the food chain. Cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.